Today on the podcast, we'll be interviewing Dr. Tim Wright. He is a pediatric dentist and a distinguished professor at the UNC Adams School of Dentistry, as well as the editor of the Journal of the American Dental Association. You are listening to the Smart Dental Student, your source for information regarding dental school and your professional journey, with your hosts, Matt Manley and Landon Guy. So, Dr. Wright, how did you first get involved with dentistry?
Oh, well, that goes back to about the time of the dinosaurs. So, you know, I have to say, as a kid, my family dentist, I was growing up in a small town in West Virginia. It was a town of like 7,000-8,000 people. My family dentist was a huge role model to me. I thought he was so cool. If you were good, he had this piece of, looked like a piece of fur. He called it his pet skunk, but it was just a black piece of material that had fuzzy stuff on it with a white stripe down the middle, black with white. If you were good, and I was like 4 years old, and I still remember this, he'd say, "If you're good, I'm going to let you," and he'd pull it out of his dental cabinet, the old, you know, little narrow thing of the dental drawers, and he let you pet it and it would kind of curl up. And this guy, I mean, and I wasn't the best dental patient by any stretch, but he actually started my orthodontics. He's a general dentist, and he started my braces on me. And then we ended up moving away. But that that practitioner had such a huge impact on me. He was a great role model. He was a really cool person. And then I thought that would be really a fun thing to do because I love to do things with my hands. I was always building models and doing things like that, but I wanted to do something that was kind of scientific. My dad was a chemist. I always had a cool chemistry set. And when I went to college, I went in pre-dent. I knew that was the direction I wanted to go. I wasn't exploring around. I did a little bit. I mean, I went out to a vet's place and watched a guy bury his arm up the back end of a cow. And I was like, yeah, that's not looking how I want to go down this road. I think the dental field's looking a little more attractive to me than the moo cow over there. So I went pre-dent and I was on the trajectory. Now, I didn't know that I would get interested in kids. That came as I was exposed to through a dental school, and afterwards I went into public health. So, and that was my exposure to kids, and then went on to do pediatric dentistry.
Was there any one moment where you knew that pediatrics is for me, or was it like a gradual process of becoming more acquainted with kids and liking them?
Well, so again, role models and mentors are hugely important. And so I was fortunate. I went to West Virginia University School of Dentistry, and they had a really outstanding pediatric dentistry department. Two of the faculty members, I had three, there were three pedo faculty. Two of those went on to be deans at dental school. One at Iowa and one at Kentucky, and the other became chair of that department and then another department. But so I had a good foundation, and they made it fun. They actually were doing like educational research. They were kind of thinking outside the box as to how to teach. And I enjoyed that too. It was a little different than the regular grind of some of the other disciplines at dental school at that time. And so when I was going to graduate and go into be a general dentist, that was my goal. And I actually wanted to go out west and ski 3 days a week and do dentistry for my ski habit. I went out there and drove around and looked for 6 weeks. I couldn't pull the trigger on a place to live that time. I was assuming the rest of my life. So I went into public health, and I was running 5 days a week, 8 to 5, a pediatric dental clinic. And I really liked the kids. And I knew that if I had a better education, I could do so much better service for those kids. And this was in southern West Virginia. I had an endless stream of children with rampant caries and disease, and frequently had complications or challenges that I just wasn't prepared to manage. And so I thought, well, this would be fun. And so that was when I applied to graduate schools in pediatric dentistry and several different ones around the country. Again, I didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I know I wanted to do something with kids, but I applied to 1 3-year master's program. I applied to a dual pedo ortho program, and I applied to a hospital dental program in California. Partly because it was California. I thought that'd be cool. So, I mean, I didn't know. And then I went on the interviews and I thought, this master's program with research sounds really interesting. And that's the one I ended up going to.
And where was that again? Which one?
Alabama.
Alabama.
Yeah. So I did it ended up a 4-year. I went through undergrad dental school in 6 years. And because at that time they were trying to push dentists out of capitation. This was in the 70s. But so I call it my remediation. I went to 4 years of graduate training and did a, it was a, called a cariology program that was research around cariology and then pediatric dentistry. And they kind of tailor-made this program for me. It was an NIH-funded postdoctoral training program coupled with pedo. So I got to do research, and they have a great children's hospital there. So it was a really good clinical program, but had some outstanding nationally, internationally renowned scientists that I got to interact and work with, which I thought was just really fun. And that was a lot of the reason why I ended up in academics and not in private practice. Because, again, I had these stellar role models that just made – and they had cool toys. We had electron microscopes and stuff like that I got to go play around with and answer questions. And a lot of it was driven by my patients, hereditary defects of their teeth and stuff. And it was like, okay, what is this? All right. Why do these teeth look that way? How can we better fix these things? And that became the, that was the driver behind my research. It all started with patient care at that during my residency, really. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it was fun.
What was it like being able to kind of go take a patient question like that, dig down deep, and then go back to them later on, or even now where you have more knowledge and you're talking to patients? What's that like?
Well, in a word, I'd have to say rewarding. It's tremendously rewarding to be able to go. I had somebody in one of my grants said, you know, he really takes it from bedside to benchtop back to bedside. You know, and the ability, and some of the things that we've developed were having new abilities to really generate smiles, in my case, and for kids mostly, but I treat some adults, but special needs adults with special genetic stuff. But that's about as rewarding as it gets. I mean, that's something that keeps me coming back to play and to work, is to be able to do that and answer questions, to provide the answers. I mean, we found a bunch of different genes that cause some of these different conditions, and then also figured out, this is probably going to work better to manage this. You know, can you bond a tooth, or do you need to do something else? Does it need full coverage? And why is the enamel all breaking down in the first place? And all of those kind of things. It's when you see the smiles on the kids and the parents and how good they feel about you doing something to help their child. Mm-hmm. It's priceless. I mean, it's just absolutely priceless. It makes the profession, to me, I can't think of a better job to have than what I get to do.
And you're kind of in a unique position, because it's not only that you're doing pediatric dentistry, but you're doing it in an academic setting, right? And so, like, and not just, like, I guess in a sense, being, you know, being lecturing and teaching and stuff like that, but you're also doing it on a research side also. So you've got a lot of, do you kind of see it almost like force multiplying? You're able to take that knowledge that you're getting from research and kind of propagate it out to your, you know, through dental channels to people who are private practice doing stuff like that. How do you see that from kind of an academic research side?
So I had this discussion with my dad, who was an academician as well, and I was trying to figure out what to do. I was in public health. I was thinking about doing a GPR and then maybe a practice. And he said, well, son, how many patients would a dentist see in a lifetime? I said, gee, Dad, I don't know. 20,000, maybe something like that. I don't know, 10, 15, I don't know. And he goes, okay, well, if you were at a dental school and you trained dentists and you taught them how to touch the lives of patients, how many do you think you would have an impact on? Mm. And it's like exponentially, I mean, many, many fold, you know, multiplicatives of what I could do as an individual. So if you want to have an impact on humanity, the hallowed halls of education are a place where you can really have a multiplier effect and do that. And so that was one of the things I thought was would be pretty cool to be able to teach. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, so I've had a lot of dental students and a lot of dental residents go through that I've been able to teach things that I learned, some the hard way, some through, you know. It's like, don't do this. This doesn't work well. I can just tell you from experience, some through research, some experience, combinations of those things. So, yeah, and being able to go out and lecture and present to clinicians who are out there in the trenches and help answer their questions about their challenging patients. And the same thing with the journal editorship, that's another forum. It's a powerful forum to be able to provide information and knowledge to people who, the end game is to help people. You're out there, it's the people that we serve, to do that at the very best that we can with the knowledge that, and hopefully timely, important knowledge that's going to help move the needle on that, so the patient care is the very best. So, yeah, academics was the right place for me with that kind of mindset. And I love my one-on-one. Don't get me wrong. I love doing the in the trenches. The kids are fun. Most of them, actually, most all of them are. But
I have a couple at home, so I've
got three and a bunch of grandkids. So, yeah, that's kind of the way I've thought about that.
What would you say is the most difficult part about balancing your life as someone in academics and also someone who's treating patients? So, like, what would you say is the most difficult aspect of doing that?
Well, time management, people who go through dental school are usually pretty good at that if you want to survive. Mm-hmm. And to be able to do the things that I've done, being able to do that and do it efficiently and not get lost trying to achieve perfection, you know, get the good and go and do the best you can and maintain a life balance so you're not just doing that all the time. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's part of the reward. It's rewarding to have the other aspects of life, to be able to have a family, to be able to enjoy the beauty, looking out the window at this beautiful blue sky, you know, that the world presents to us. And some of that's in people and some of it's in geography and, you know, some of it's in knowledge. And so the challenge is to find that sweet spot balance to do all those things, and have fun. I'm driven by having fun. And so, when I get to the point where I'm thinking something is becoming a grind and it's no longer fun, I need to rethink about what I'm doing. And is that really where I want to put my time? And I've been blessed because most of the time, having the diversity of academics, where I am teaching at some time, I am doing research, sometimes I'm doing patient care, sometimes I'm traveling, sometimes I'm doing editorship. There's a lot of diversity in there, so you don't get a whole lot of time to get bored with stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, if I get bored with that, I'll move on to this. Or if I'm stuck, I can go over here and do something. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go treat a patient. That's instant gratification. Some of the other things are a little slower. So, that's a big challenging part, is just trying to get that balance and to keep it in balance so that it stays fresh and it stays fun.
No, one thing that I've talked to with people in private practice, especially business owners, they said that when they go home, it's really easy to take work home with them. Would you say you would have that same experience being in academics and working in, you know, a university setting? Or are you able to go home and able to separate yourself from your work when you do get home?
A lot of work gets done at home. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like, today I'm not working. You know, tonight is my time, my family time. A sage person, I was a young faculty member, and I was setting up an experiment. It was Friday night and it was 5:00 and he was leaving, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm setting this up and, you know, I'm going to get this ready to run and do this." And he goes, "You got kids at home, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." He goes, "Let me tell you something. Your legacy is not whatever paper you may write from this experiment that a few people may read and it'll get dusty in some library. The legacy you're going to leave is your family and your children. You will be alive and remembered as long as your memory with those people stay alive. You should go home and spend time with your family." And I took that to heart. I mean, that was sage. That was some sage wording that he gave me, you know, advice that he gave me. And, I have to do a lot of stuff on the weekends or on a night, but I pick those and selectively choose those so that it's like, and I'll get up early and I'll get my work done so that when everybody else gets up, I'm ready to play or do whatever it is. There's, you know, and I'm on call. I was on call this weekend. So one of my grandkids came over for dinner and he's there and I'm trying to answer a page and stuff and, you know, doing that instead of going out and telling him, hey. But as soon as I was done, then I was done. And I spent the rest of my time for the day and the evening with him. So, again, it's that balance of trying to do that. But, yeah, it's not an 8-to-5. My life has not been 8-to-5. But you got to find that sweet spot of how you're going to balance that out.
Do you find, especially since, you know, when you were younger, you had younger kids at home, now kids aren't at home per se. And so what does that look like for, I guess, because like right now I've got kids at home. And so I've got a season in which, you know, I have my young kids, they're in the young stage, and then I'm going to be hopefully a provider someday. So then I'm going to have kind of middle-age-ish kids, and they'll be like teenagers and stuff, and then you're an empty nester and you're still providing or something. What have you seen as far as like different seasons in your life and how that kind of impacted your balance?
Well, so they're all different, and you know, one, and you never get to go back. You've only got babies once, and you've only got it. My kids were, I have three kids, and they were spread out over a decade. So that season lasted a long time. my first one, I was a freshman in dental school, and I had one in graduate school and one when I first started my job, my first full-time academic job. And so, but yeah, all of those are fun seasons, and they do change, and so does your lifestyle. So as I went through those, I went through dental school, and that was one, and then I got a job and in public health, and I was with my four-year-old at that point, three- or four-year-old, and he and I would take a bus to, I'd go down to the Cabell Huntington Health Department in West Virginia, and I'd go to work, and I'd drop him off at daycare. My wife was still in school in Morgantown, and I was in the southern part of the state. So single parenting it for like 6-8 months until she got done and then came down with us. But yeah, so there was that. And then as they got to be older and teenagers, and your roles change with your kids and your parents, I mean, your family, you know, I've got three brothers. And so those relationships too, which are all have been and are still extremely important in my life. And so, yeah, the seasons of life, and I'm in a, you know, a different season now. I'm older, and my kids are grown. I've got grandkids, and so, but that's fun. Having grandkids is rewarding. Made me really glad I didn't, you know, check my kids out because they gave me grandkids. So, you know, it's like, oh, I feel better about keeping you around like I did and taking care of you. So, yeah, but, and same with the profession, and that changes along. And I never had a roadmap out to where it was like, this is what I've envisioned myself doing in 10 years or 15 years. And I still don't really have that, because as opportunities opened and doors opened, and I saw that looks like a fun thing to do. Again, the driver, that would be fun, probably useful, but it would be enjoyable. And there's parts of it that I would find engaging and satiating. And so those are the things that I've done over the years. I've moved from one thing to the next with some foundations of, you know, what I'm trying to do. But I never envisioned being an editor. I never envisioned being chair of a department. I never envisioned, those were not things that I was like, that's my goal.
I want to do this.
Yeah. It's like, well, I never really thought about that. That might be kind of cool. I might be able to do that pretty well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's try that for a while. So yeah, rolling that for a while. That's it. And as long as it's fun, I keep doing it to a point. I mean, I did my chair thing for 10 years. It's 5-year appointments. And at that point I thought, you know, it's been a good run. Somebody else needs to come do this. Put their stamp on this. Bring, you know, so their vision. I did my 10 years and did a lot of stuff, and decided to move on. So I did something else fun.
So what is your, just generally speaking, what does your day-to-day look like?
Well, and that's changed a lot over the years too. When I was grant funded, it used to be, I'd have a couple of days of research and a couple of days of teaching, and a day of patient care. Right now, things are kind of different since COVID. They've changed a lot. But on paper, I do a day and a half-ish of editorial work. I do every other week. I'm in the operating room all day. I see faculty practice patients, so I see my own private patients a half a day every week. Then I'm in clinic with mostly with the grad students, some with the DDS students, but mostly with the grad students is where they've deployed me. And I teach courses with them, the treatment planning course, every week. And I do components of that myself. I do what I call case of the week, and I present a challenge case, and they've got to figure out what it is. But they've got a week to do it, because I'll present the pictures and then the history and stuff, and I'll say, okay, differential diagnoses, what would you do? How would you manage this in your practice? It also helps prepare them for the oral boards. And so anyway, it's, you know, every day is a little bit different of what I'm doing. So it's a lot of clinic right now, but part of that's teaching, and some of it's my own patient care, operating room, which I really enjoy. We see a lot of medically compromised, complex patients in the hospital, and that's fun too. So yeah, and then the journal work. And traveling. I flew to Phoenix last week, the week before, to teach a four-day course for oral preps, board preps, and then a comprehensive review for pediatric dentists, mm-hmm. which had been my first time back in front of a big live audience mm-hmm. since the early part of 2020. I had a couple of gigs, but and that's fun. Give me a microphone and an audience, I'm all over it. So it was fun. Yeah, and so, yeah, I'm going to the ADA meeting, and I usually didn't ever attend that, but I'm going. They've got a special science session with the editorial, and we're going to do a little mm-hmm. dog and pony show with a couple of outstanding research people and like emerging sciences and where's dentistry headed and what are some, as best as people can figure out, what are possible avenues for the future and directions for oral health care and that. So, yeah, that's fun.
Being that you do, you know, the editorialship and stuff like that, how do you kind of, I guess, do you sit down and be like, okay, over the next 12 months, this is kind of the goal of each issue, or this is like, how do you compile those articles, select them, stuff like that?
Yeah, so no, there's not a roadmap for 12 months. I mean, there are things that I've thought about for the future that would be timing-wise, like, for example, the Surgeon General's report, which isn't going to come out as a Surgeon General's report, but the report's still going to be published. We've known about that for a long time. So trying to coordinate things at the first of the year to have an editorial that might, you know, help do that. They want to publish part of it in the journal, which they haven't seen yet, but those are discussions that they're having. But the journal itself is a day-to-day operation. And so I don't know what's coming down the pike. For the most part, they are authors submit manuscripts and I review those, and I either think they're good science and they're good knowledge and they're nicely written so they're readable, mm-hmm. or they could be copy edited to where they would be readable if they're not, because we get a lot of international, not everybody speaks English first language, sure. and we can help with that. Mm-hmm. But that's what determines what goes in the journal. It gets peer reviewed. So I look at it and I say, well, yeah, this looks interesting. And I may assign it to an associate editor and then they'll get reviewers. They get reviewed and then they usually go back to authors with suggestions to strengthen it, ask questions, clarify points, do other additional statistics or things like that. And it's that then becomes the fodder for what I can build each issue out of.
Okay.
And so we have a backlog, not a huge backlog, because we're pretty fast from acceptance to publication. But so on any given issue, you may have everything from a COVID paper to a digital dentistry paper to a case report on some, you know, interesting auto transplantation of a tooth, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is, that then becomes the, and there's a, that becomes what's in that issue. And there's usually around 9 manuscripts per issue. With editorials and then commentaries and maybe letters to the editor are meant to be a forum for promoting discussion. So if you've got a question mm-hmm. about a manuscript or you don't agree with what their conclusion was, mm-hmm. you can write a letter to the editor. And if it's well done, and I think that it adds to the
discussion
and helps elevate our knowledge as a community of practitioners, then we'll publish
that in there.
Yeah, we'll publish that. So, and I've done some of the editorials and I've had guest editorials. I just had the one in October is the incoming president for the ADA, and I invited him to do that.
Nice.
I actually invited Anthony Fauci. He turned me down. But I thought, man, that would be awesome, like in March to say, we're 2 years out. Dentistry's got to, we've definitely got a, you know, part in this game. Mm-hmm. We're in aerosol land and yeah. we've done very well mm-hmm. and we've adopted PPE back in the 80s with the HIV pandemic. And, but he's like, and he didn't even respond, but they did respond at NIH and they said, he's really busy. And I said, I know, but I had to ask.
Sure. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, but there are certain things, and I've started a new, by invitation, it's called Oral Science Trends. And those are reviews. And the first one will be coming out in December. And that was on COVID and how it wasn't just COVID. It was like pandemics and how do we get kind of where we are and what are we thinking this is going to hold for the future and mm-hmm. lessons learned as we march through this. So that'll be in the December issue.
Yeah. Cause it, I mean, going, you know, eyes open, this won't be the last pandemic humanity faces. So
it hasn't been not the first, and it won't be the last. Yeah, there's no way. So yeah, and how things have changed, and there's some. I just got this paper, so it's like right at the. We just got it ready to go, but. Yeah, it's got some really interesting sort of historical perspectives of how we got here, what we've learned over the last almost 2 years now, and some areas where some things that have bubbled up during this time probably going to actually improve our ability to do what we do. Teledentistry, for example, this was an opportunity. It didn't really catch on to the point where it could have, but some of these things that are new technologies, the science behind, I mean, even the vaccines, to be able to put vaccines out that fast, and now they're doing artificial intelligence to, you know, predict what the different mutations and the proteins might be, so you could proactively make a new vaccine to be preemptive. So it's some cool stuff in there. That'll be in December issue. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Well, you're the first to hear that. So.
That's great. So could you let our listeners kind of know how you even came across being the editor, or how you got involved?
How did that even happen?
Well, so I was at home because it was COVID time, and this was probably in the spring of 2020, I guess. Yeah, and I got a call from the search committee, and I hadn't really thought about it. I knew that there had been a change, but I didn't know what the process was or anything. But the search committee from the ADA called me and said that my name had come up as a possibility. And would I think about it, or had I thought about it? I said, no, I've never thought about it. No, I never even thought about it. I was an associate editor at the time for Archives of World Biology. Okay. And that one, I had been on their editorial board for years, and a position apparently came open, and they called and said, hey, would you be associate editor? So I'd done that for a couple of years. I had some idea of the flow and kind of the whole process.
Like.
Yeah, and I was actually using the same computer program that they use for the journal for JOTA. But and so anyway, I thought about it, and I thought it was in the middle of COVID, so I wasn't lecturing, I wasn't flying around. At that time, I wasn't even at school, because we were still sort of shut down. Mm-hmm. It was between that March and July when we weren't here.
Trying to figure things out.
Yeah, so I was vulnerable. But I was looking for opportunities. I mean, I was like, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And that came up, and I thought, you know, again, back to that educational component, this is a powerful forum to be able to provide knowledge to massive numbers of people. I mean, across the globe, not just within the United States. And so I said, yeah, I'll think about that. And I actually asked, I went back to Michael Glick, who had been the editor for 15 years. They had an interim editor at the time, but I knew him peripherally, but I had published there, and I had met him a few times. And so I called him up. I said, hey, would you talk to me about this? Mm-hmm. And he said, it is a, you know, you got to love it to do it. You know, it's not something you just want to say, oh, I just do that on the side. He goes, you need to be pretty passionate about it if you want to do this. And he's right, because it's a fire hose of stuff coming at you every day. And if you didn't like to read, and you didn't like to do some of those things, or have the ability to reject manuscripts from people that may be your friends, you've got to have a little bit of a thick skin to be able to do those kind of things. I've had people said, I'd never be an editor because I would hate to have to reject papers from people that I know and stuff. And I don't enjoy that, but, you know, you do what you need to do. Yeah. Ultimately, it's the science and the information is the driver. It's not my friendship with an individual. Mm-hmm. It's like I have a responsibility to the greater good to make sure that whatever goes in that journal is the very best it could possibly be and the very best useful information that I could possibly put in there. And as long as I have that sort of a foundational piece, then that's good. But yeah, anyway, that's how I got into it. They called me, and I didn't know, so I hadn't even really thought about it. But it's been fun.
Do you? I know a lot of times, at least from my own perspective, I feel like it's easy to be like, oh, you know, I'm going to dental school right now. I'm going to be a dentist someday. Is it even important for me to keep up and read professional journals? You know, is it important for me to take the time out of my day to sit down and read, you know? And I kind of have an idea of what you would say to that. But, but you know, from your perspective, how would we sell someone who may be hesitant to subscribe to reading professional journals and kind of staying up on the latest science?
Well, so one is if you want to ever move on and be any better than you are today, you've got to do something to make that happen. And the way that you do that is continue to educate yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a variety of ways you could do that. Reading is, I think, is one of the more valuable ones. I mean, you can read your phone and you can read social media, and there's a lot of people get a lot of information real fast that way these days. Some of that's good information, some of that's clearly not good information. And we have tons of that these days, and some people have a hard time delineating, you know, what that is. When you look at a journal, a reputable journal, because there are some journals out there that are not of such high caliber either. There's what they call predatory journals that are out there, you know, soliciting this and that and really hunting down to get people to put in publications. But the journals, the good journals that, again, take the responsibility seriously and do a really good job at making sure that that's peer-reviewed, that the science is good, the statistical analyses are appropriate, the conclusions match what it is that they actually found and not just their own dogma and bias, which you'll see that mm-hmm. too. That gives you a source of a fidelity of knowledge, of a fidelity in the information that you're getting, that you're not going to be able to get off of a social media website or those kind of things. So if you want to know, it's not as fast as social media for sure. And, you know, it's a little slower to read an article than to watch a TikTok video, but maybe not quite as much fun sometimes. But, but yeah, I mean, and I think people who don't do that, who don't continue to learn through whatever form, I mean, and it shouldn't just be one. I mean, I go to CE, I teach CE, I read, I do watch videos of things. I watch a technique video, or I go onto YouTube sometimes and just see people are talking about stuff. There's all kinds of stuff on some social media. I don't go to websites a whole lot. I have a few that I sort of track peripherally. They're not my go-to places, but all of those collectively provide information that I can then use to help hopefully improve what I do, the way I think about my patients, the way I communicate with my patients, the way I can treat my patients. And so, yeah, I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, I can't, if I hadn't done all that 40 years, I'd be doing dentistry from the 1970s. I'd still be doing gold foils and, you know, you guys don't even know what this, like sanitary ponics. I mean, these things are archaic at this point. And people would go, "What? You did what?" I said, "Yeah, that's what they taught me in dental school. I had a whole bunch of requirements. I had to do 25 of those to graduate. I mean, nobody even does them anymore." So, yeah, you gotta learn to move on. And today, with the amount of information and knowledge that's coming out, it's even more important because the pace of change and a lot of the things that we teach in dental school today is not what you're going to be doing in 20 years, mm-hmm. certainly not in 40 years. So the only way you keep apprised of that is through continued education. And don't just get wed to one media, you know, use different media. But mm-hmm. reading, I think, is a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, especially if you're literate, you can read for free most of the time, unless you're, you know, needing to subscribe to something that you pay for. But mm-hmm. for the most part, you can pick up stuff relatively inexpensively.
Well, and publications are going more and more to open access, so you don't even have to have a subscription. In fact, the JOTA Online, when it first goes up, there's a whole bunch of it that goes up. It's open access. It's, you can go to their website if you're a member of the ADA. If you're not a member, I don't know if you have access to it, but eventually all the open access things everybody's got access to. Mm-hmm. And there are certain publications in that journal that are of that ilk. And then there's other journals that are already completely open access. Now those authors have to pay to put those up. They pay $2,000, $3,000 to publish it. That's not true with a subscription journal like for JOTA. But they've just starting one called Foundational Sciences that is completely open access. They have not rolled out the first issue yet, but that'll be an online publication, and everybody will have free access to all that information. And that'll roll out here in the not-too-distant future.
Speaking of you know, those kind of journals, are there some that stand out in your mind as far as a good, reputable? Because, I mean, I'm going to be honest, and other than the class that we had, you know, in our D1 year where it was like, hey, this is how you
evidence-based stuff.
Yeah, evidence-based. Other than that, I have a very hard time sitting down and personally feeling confident in my ability to differentiate between a good trial or a bad trial or a good article, a bad article, or one that's maybe not as strong.
Yeah, so another way people do that in practice, a lot of practitioners participate in study clubs. And then you can sort of scan, you know, you'll have other people with other expertise. I can't tell on all. I don't know. The statistics have gotten so complicated. I don't know all. I'm not a biostatistician. And even biostatisticians argue about the stats, right? There are certain journals that are going to be better than others. And one way you look at it is the caliber. They have a thing called impact factor, how often they get cited and those kind of things. But if you're looking at most of the, and there's a lot of dental journals out there, actually, if you include all the state and everything else, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of journals, dental journals. I mean, there's tons and tons of other publications. But so if you're looking at the big organizations, especially, you know, like endodontics or prosthodontics or perio, the highest impact factor is perio 2000, which is review articles. Bajada and especially the ones that are the masthead for the different specialties, those are all pretty reputable. And not to say that everybody might not have a bad article time to time, but by and large, those are going to provide pretty good information. And being able to read them and understand all the nuances of that, there are courses in that the ADA offers, evidence-based dentistry courses. The Academy of Pediatric Dentistry is offering those. Getting to, you know, if you want to learn more about those things, there are opportunities there. Being a reviewer for a journal, having some of those skill sets. So the publishing houses also have training that they provide online to learn about doing some of that. I actually was just in talking Elsevier as the publisher for JADA and said, could we make all this available to all the reviewers? They could really benefit from this kind of knowledge. And they said, yeah, we could actually provide the link when we invite them to be a reviewer so that they'd have access. And so there's like, I don't know, 12 online modules for, you know, how to review papers and training. Yeah. So, I mean, you got to take some personal gumption to go do all that stuff. But yeah, there's opportunities out there to learn some of those things and enhance your skills.
Makes you more credible as you're
If you're going to be a reviewer, it's really helpful to have that. And there's reviewers who do a great job, and there's reviewers who, if they write, oh, this is a great paper, that's not really helpful. You want people who are really going to look at it and strengthen it through some constructive comments. So, yeah.
What, like, if you could go back in time, and two specific areas, one being going into peds and then the other going into academics, what would you go back in time and kind of tell yourself before going into peds and before going into academics? Like a piece of advice or something like that?
Well, I can tell you this. I wouldn't change either one of those decisions for sure. I thought they were both really good decisions. The institutions that I went to, I knew the limitations of those when I did it. I had talked to somebody about Alabama, and they said, yeah, you know, it's kind of got average faculty and stuff. He said the research place is great. The library, that was one of the strengths that they said. At that time, it wasn't all electronic, right? You had to actually go to the library and pull out its stacks and look at a journal, and which I did regularly. I like carved time out on Friday afternoon. I'd get a couple of hours and go through the stacks. And it was a medical as well as a dental. So I could be looking at the genetics journals I could be looking at New England Journal of Medicine. And so I would just go through there and flip through stuff and just, you know, clog my brain up with stuff. Like, wow, man, I never knew that. That's pretty wild. So, yeah, I guess if I was going to tell myself, part of it would be I would tell myself what the fella told me at 5 o'clock was to, you know, keep things in balance. You don't have to do it. And dental school, that was tough because dental school was like, it was like all out just to get through the thing. You know, it was like memorizing Gray's Anatomy for, you know, stuff. It was like, holy cow, which in reality, you don't need to do all of that stuff. You need to get through and you need to get as much as you can. But part of it would be to have that balance so that you go through this not killing yourself and not getting ulcers and not, you know, ending up in divorce and your kids don't know who you are, you know, that kind of stuff. I could have learned that lesson a little bit faster. Would have been, had that been before dental school, that would have been nice because I was married when I went to dental school. So, and I didn't get divorced. I'm still married to the same woman, but it might have made some of that a little smoother. And then in academics, I guess it would have been just keep your eyes open and see what's coming down the pike. And my dad always said, you know, do a good job and opportunities will avail themselves. And so that was, and I listened to his words of advice, but that's somebody, if I was going to tell somebody else, it's like, excel at what you do and you will have opportunities you didn't even ever imagine that will open doors and things will happen for you. And that was true. That's how I ended up here. I had gotten a grant, got funded, and they said, oh, he looks like he's good. I mean, he's publishing. He's paying his own salary, for gosh sakes. He's not even going to cost us anything. Let's hire that dude. So, yeah. But do a good job would be, but have fun while you're doing it. Mm-hmm. Don't do it to the detriment of all the rest of a fun life. So,
what advice would you give to someone who's maybe sitting on the fence about applying to a pediatrics program?
Well, it's chase your passion. Figure out, and if you're not sure, don't do it. Figure out what it is that you're passionate about and what part of it maybe you're passionate mm-hmm. about. So if you're thinking, well, I'm not really sure, then I wouldn't pull the trigger on that. I would wait till I was sure. Take a year and learn, you know, go work mm-hmm. as an associate with a lot of kids in a practice, family practice, or even a pedo office. So until you know pretty much what you want to do, don't commit a big chunk of your mm-hmm. life to something and go down the wrong path. I had a daughter I didn't talk her out of it. She was applying to med school, and I was reading her why I want to be a doctor. And I said, I'm not seeing the passion here for this. She mm-hmm. goes, well, it was kind of always in the back of my mind. I said, no, it needs to be burning a hole in your frontal lobe. Mm-hmm. Unless you're passionate about this, you're young, do something else, figure it out before you make that call. Mm-hmm. So same with pedo. Most people that know pedo, they seem to like pedo. You know, mm-hmm. everybody's like, "Oh, I love kids." I was like, yeah, okay.
Take
yeah,
it bit by one.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. You can have my firstborn. So, yeah, that's not just a reason to do it. I mean, you got to think about it. So, and you need to explore that. Mm-hmm. But if they're, you know, if they're on the fence about it, then I'd stay on the fence until you figured it out, and you fall mm-hmm. over on the side and go, "Oh man, this is great." And you don't know for sure till you do it. And there's a lot of different ways to make that into what you want it to be. Mm-hmm. A lot of people run a multiple practices, or you run a small practice and do that, or you can go into academics, or you can go into public health, or you could, you know, there's all kinds of different mm-hmm. ways to do that that can be really fun that fit what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to do that forever. You could do one. We've got a person that's coming back in as grad program director for PETA, has been in private practice for, he trained here and has been in private practice here in North Carolina. He's coming back as full-time faculty after, I don't know, 25 years maybe wow. in private practice. So he ought to be pretty good at that mm-hmm. now. He shouldn't be practicing anymore. See, now he's going to come back and educate. So mm-hmm. he got it down.
What would be some ways that you've given us a few tidbits of like what to expect with JADA and stuff coming up in the future, but like if anybody wanted to reach out to you or had questions about peds or had questions about academic dentistry or even about editorialship or stuff like that, what would be ways folks can reach out and get in touch with you? Email.
Yeah. tim_wright@unc.edu. Yeah, just email me. I'm pretty good at answering emails. And then it might, you know, if they want to chat, we can set up a Zoom or they can come by the office or do whatever. But yeah, I'm usually pretty good about responding. And happy to talk to people. I love talking to students or what I call the dental wannabes. If you want to be a dentist and you're thinking mm-hmm. about it, you know, I've got kids coming up from campus. And so, yeah, happy to chat with people.
You have been listening to The Smart Dental Student. The views, information, and opinions expressed during this recording are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent the organizations that the individuals are affiliated with. If you enjoyed the content of this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Also, you can follow us on Instagram @smartdentalstudent or visit our website for more information at smartdentalstudent.com.